Hey, scientists, how critical is pure water to you? In this new podcast, Lab Water Stories Unfiltered, we at Millipore Sigma look closer at this often overlooked lab essential. Tune in as experts drop tips and insights not found in textbooks, taken from their work with MilliQ Lab Water Solutions. Lab Water Stories Unfiltered. Find it wherever you get your podcasts. Millipore Sigma is the U.S. and Canada life science business of Merck KGaA Darmstadt, Germany.
Welcome to Teacher Quit Talk. I'm Miss Redacted.
And I'm Mrs. Frazzled. Every week we explore the teacher exodus to find out what, if anything, could get these educators back in the classroom.
We've all had our moments where we thought, what the hell am I doing here? From burnout to bureaucracy to soul-sucking stressors and creative dead ends.
From recognizing when it was time to go to navigating feelings of guilt and regret afterwards, we're here to cut out the gaslighting and get real about what it means to leave teaching.
We've got insights from former teachers from all over the country who have seen it all. So get ready to be disturbed. Join us on Teacher Quit Talk to laugh through the pain of the U.S. education system. We'll see you there.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
Привіт. Це щотижнева програма про політику.
L'histoire, la sécurité nationale,
crimen organizado, dinero sucio,
globale corruption, та боротьбу за демократію.
Et ahora,
ATP.
Et maintenant,
con ustedes, su anfitrión,
Grégoire.
Welcome to the fight. This time I know our side will win.
I'm Greg Oliar. This is Prevail. Welcome to the program. We've got a great show. The president of the Amazon conservation team, Mark Plotkin, is here. Mark is an ethnobotanist by trade, and we get into that. He's written several books, including Tales of a Shaman's Apprentice, which is also a documentary featuring him, Medicine Quest, In Search of Nature's Healing Secrets, and most recently, The Amazon, What Everyone Needs to Know. He also has an excellent podcast called Plants of the Gods, where he talks about various plants and things found in nature that have medicinal properties and stuff like that. So super interesting. It's a little bit of a detour from what we usually talk about here at Prevail, but it's super interesting. He's great and very, very funny. I laughed a lot during the episode. And, you know, honestly, I need a little detour. This has been a weird week. The news is not, it's been sort of bleak this week, you know, and there's so many terrible things happening. But the one thing I wanted to talk about up front, just quickly, once again, we've had a school shooting. Once again, it's like little kids under the age of 10, you know, who died. Once again, the Republicans are just fucking completely useless. Just useless, soulless ghouls. Almost comically so. I mean, it's almost a parody of itself how soulless these fucking people are and how steeped in this weird gun culture. I don't even know if we can call it gun culture. You know, we have the guy from Tennessee, Andy Ogles. I've made fun of his name before because it could be Andy, you know, molests, Andy grooms. I guess Andy does groom because he's got pictures of like his like toddler kids with these big guns on his Insta. And I mean, I just don't understand that. You know, it's one thing to say, okay, I believe the Second Amendment, we have a right to bear arms, blah, blah, blah. But in what reality is it okay to expose your toddler to this sort of horrible death machine? I mean, what brain would think that that is okay? You know, there's lots of things that adults enjoy that are not suitable for children. You know, I like my Manhattan as people who watch the 5-8 know, that doesn't mean I'm going to like mix one up and put it in a bottle and feed it to my fucking toddler. Come on, dude. There's something wrong fundamentally with this. It's gotten way too crazy. And I don't know what the solution is, but this stuff keeps happening. We keep pushing back against it. And then the moment passes. And because of the composition of the Senate and stuff like that, nothing can get done, even though the vast majority of American people want meaningful gun reform. There's been a lot of blame on the NRA, and certainly the NRA is awful. But we need to remember here that the NRA was infiltrated by Russians. You know, Maria Butina was in there. Alexander Torshin was in there. These NRA high ups were just in with the Russians. And I know people are like, Greg thinks everything's Russia, blah, blah, blah. But this is a case where it actually happened. And why are they infiltrating the NRA? What do they want out of that? You know, there are gun laws in Russia. They don't have this kind of stuff going on there. So why does he want it here? Why do the Russians want to influence policy here to make guns more readily available? Because they want this shit to happen, okay? They cannot beat us militarily. They're trying to beat us in other ways. And one of the ways that they're beating us is by arming us to the teeth, spewing out this garbage 2A propaganda, and just sitting back and watching us kill each other with these mass shootings. This is something that's real and is happening. And, you know, nobody's really talking about it in that way. This is part of the op. If we're at war with these forces that, you know, it's not just Putin, but that these autocracies that are trying to hit at democracy, this is one place where the war is happening. And we have to be more awake to that and recognize what the fuck is happening. And that's the way it should be framed, in my opinion. Trying to split hairs about what the Second Amendment means is not the right way to approach this. The right way to approach this is, hey, there is a global war going on right now between the forces of fascism and the forces of democracy. This shit belongs to the forces of fascism. It's enabling, it's making us weaker. That's what it's doing. All the gun violence just makes us weaker. And they win when this shit happens. They win every fucking time. And you look at the politicians that support all of this stuff, your Ted Cruz's and these sleazebag people like that. Lindsey Graham had a terrible statement yesterday. What do they all have in common? I mean, come on, how much more obvious can this shit get? So look, it's hard for me to process this. It's so sad. It's so terrible. And the solutions are so fucking obvious that it boggles the mind why we can't do something about it. Somebody tweeted that, you know, the gun control debate ended after Sandy Hook, because once we decided that it was okay to sacrifice children, that's it. Where do we go from there? If the Republicans are okay with that, that they have no soul, they can't be bargained with. And that's where we are now. And it really makes me sad and angry. Well, what can you do about it? I loved that Jamal Bowman shouting at that idiot Massie in Congress. Maybe we need more of that. I don't know. I'm fresh out of ideas, but I'm telling you right now, it's not just the NRA that's up to this shit. This is what they want, the bad guys want, okay, in this global battle. And we have to recognize it. It's a front in that war. And that's what it is. So anyway, lots of other bad stuff going on. I don't want to talk about it. Maybe we'll talk about it on the 5-8. One more announcement up front is that I'm taking the week off from all content creation. This is going to be the last podcast until next Friday, which is the whatever it is, April something, 14th, I think. I'll be back that week. I'm taking the full spring break week off. And the next time you hear from me content-wise after tonight's 5-8 will be on Easter Sunday. I'll write a Sunday page. So you have that to look forward to. In the meantime, I've talked long enough. We'll be right back with Mark Plotkin.
Down in Tallahassee, in bed with a mom, lives Governor Meatball, and he wants the top job. He's taking on Disney, he's fighting with Trump, but he sounds like a wussy when he speaks on the stump. He's a crystal fascist. He banned all the books. His wife is a fame whore, and his lackeys all crooks. The voters see through him. He'd say they've been groomed. Poor Governor Meatball, his campaign is doomed.
Mark Plotkin, welcome to Prevail Podcast.
Good to be here. I'm a loyal listener.
It's great to have you on. I've been wanting to talk to you for some time. You also have a podcast, which is excellent, which we'll talk to later, Plants of the Gods. And you know a lot of really interesting things, and you know a lot of interesting things about a subject that I know very little about, which is science, but very specifically ethnobotany. What is that? Just for, you know, the remedial listeners, meaning me. How do you define that?
Very simply, ethnobotany is the study of people and plants and how they're interrelated. But for most ethnobotanists, we make a living in the tropics working with indigenous healers. Because as my mentor would say, we may have degrees from Harvard and Yale, but these guys running around in penis strings know a lot more than we do.
So when did your interest in this begin? Were you a little kid, or how did you decide that this was going to be your career?
You know, I grew up in New Orleans, and I was always interested in nature, particularly in reptiles. But I was a college dropout and took a class in the night school at Harvard, where I was working as a schlub. And it was the botany and chemistry of hallucinogenic plants, which, this being the tail end of the 60s in a cultural sense, the idea of hallucinogens and primitive cultures and rainforests was pretty appealing. I guess I haven't outgrown it yet.
Okay, so that's interesting. I didn't realize you grew up in New Orleans. Maybe I did know that. I love New Orleans. It's such a great city. What was it like to grow up there? Were you in the Bourbon Street? Like, what part of the city did you live in?
No, two blocks over.
Okay.
I lived uptown near Tulane University, but my father ran a shoe store in the French Quarter. So I'd spend every waking moment that I could in the French Quarter, which was the crossroads of cultures surrounded by pimps, whores, musicians, jugglers, weirdos, Sicilians, I mean, you name it. And so it was a great sort of pre-introduction to ethnobotany. The idea, it wasn't just a bunch of white guys, and that people could live pretty basically and live well and, you know, have the senses stimulated.
Fascinating. So, okay, so you went to the Amazon. You've spent a lot of time in the Amazon region with the indigenous people. You were a shaman's apprentice and wrote a book about it. So tell everybody how did you wangle that? Like, is it through the schooling, or did you just show up there one day how did that happen?
Well, I was working in a museum, and there was a fellow there who said he really needed some help in the field. He was a graduate student named Russ Mittermeier. And I thought, this guy's the most swashbuckling adventurer I've ever met. So I said, well, I'll go. I mean, I'll save the money and I'll pay my own way if I can sort of follow you. And he said, come on along. That was 1977. So in a sense, I'm still at it. And so it was an investment in myself to pay my own way down there, which I think keeps a lot of people from undertaking these adventures. And then I got into graduate school and could get my way paid down there. And then I got a job and could get my way paid down there and draw salaries. It's a very simple version of it, but it started out just kind of, I was a kid looking for something to do, looking for adventure, looking for romance, and ended up in the rainforest, and I'm still there.
When you say you go to the Amazon, I, in my mind, you know, which is just based on like cities and urban centers, that's just a big blank spot in the map of my mind. So how do you even get there? This is, again, I'm going to ask you very remedial questions at
sure.
certain points. So please forgive my stupidity in this area, but when you fly to Rio or something, how do you get there?
I have had the honor and privilege of working with indigenous healers from southern Brazil to southern Mexico. So I covered a lot of ground. But the area that I know best is the Northeast Amazon, where Suriname, Guyana, French Guiana, and Brazil come together. It's really an overlooked part of the world in terms of the scientific community. So to get there, I've got to fly to Suriname, which involves flying to Miami, flying to Port of Spain, Trinidad, flying to Paramaribo, Suriname, and then finding a cargo plane to the interior, because not all planes can land at this little Indian village. And so, ironically, I just figured it takes me longer to get to Paramaribo, Suriname in South America than it would to get to Nairobi. That's how remote it is and how few flights go there. I once asked the American ambassador if he knew how many American tourists had been to Suriname last year. And he said, yes, I know exactly, 46. So it's gone up quite a bit since then, but not a whole lot.
My boss at my day job went there once to get banknotes and years ago. And he said it was one of the hardest places to get to and one of the most remote places. And then I think he got there on a Friday and he had to stay there for like 2 weeks or something like that. And it was really, you know, not a lot to do. I think maybe the restaurant scene wasn't quite, all there. But so my point in getting at this is you really... In the modern age, when you know, one can take a tunnel to get from London to Brussels in like an hour or whatever it is,
right?
This is quite an undertaking to go to the interior of the thing, of the Amazon. Is, you know, it's far, and it's even just getting there is quite a travel. So, okay, so talk about the well. First of all, you mentioned you go to school. You have a PhD. Where did you get the PhD? What is it in? And then that. Got you to the Amazon? Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, well, because I was a dropout working at a university, I was able to take night school courses, and I fell under the spell of a fellow who's been called the father of ethnobotany, Richard Schultes. And so I took all of his courses, some of them three times, quite obsessive. My mother says I like college so much I crammed 4 years into seven. So when I finally finished, I got a scholarship to the Yale School of Forestry, and I did a master's there. Then I went back to Harvard working as a researcher. And Schultes had retired by then, but I wanted to get a PhD, and I was able to enroll in a program at Tufts and have him on my thesis committee, which I wouldn't have been able to do at Harvard. So it was a bit of a checkered career, not a straight line, but, you know, I think that it's kind of short-sighted to force 18-year-old kids to figure out what they want to be when they grow up. When I was 18, I had two things in my mind, and neither of them was my career or a job.
Right. It's hallucinogenics. You've already mentioned the draw.
That's one of them, yeah.
I think I can guess what the other one probably was.
I think so, too.
Yeah, LSU football. Yeah, sure. okay, so talk about the experience with you're there. A shaman is an expert in these things. That's part of the indigenous population that knows about the plants and the animal life in the area. Do I have it? Is that accurate? Or
yeah, a shaman is a healer. It's in the Amazon. It's usually a man, but not always. And he or she is an expert in plants, is an expert in the spirit world, is an expert in the weather, is a keeper of legends, is a lawgiver. I mean, it's really kind of one stop shopping. And the two pillars of shamanic medicine, well, let me back up. The two pillars of Western medicine, from my perspective, were the chemistry, in other words, what's in the pills, and the technology, x-rays, CAT scans, what have you. The two pillars of shamanic medicine, or the chemistry, what's in the plants, and we now know they use insects and frogs medicinally as well, and this sort of spirit world, placebo world, invisible world, that of course, Westerners have no real knowledge of and can't manage it. That's why shamans can sometimes heal things that Western physicians cannot. The mistake that people make is they hear about hallucinogens and they think, okay, that's the answer. I could buy this stuff off the internet and heal myself. Or that shamans have all the answers for everything, which is equally silly. The middle ground is somewhere in between the microchip and the shaman. It's not one or the other.
that's the right line. Now, you've written extensively about this, and recently you wrote a piece in the Times, you know, sort of covering all of these amazing medical things that scientists have figured out based on discoveries in the Amazon, right? And to me, that's sort of a mind blow, because again, I know nothing about science in general is not my strong suit. But you know, you get a pill from the pharmaceutical place, I have no idea. It's just a pill. I don't know what's in it or how it got made or why it works or anything like that. So to go through there and try to figure out how scientists devise this stuff is pretty fascinating. One of the things that they, you know, that you mentioned in the piece is about the venoms and the poisons that are used. And there was the, you know, the scientist from the guy that says the dose is the poison, right? What's his name?
Paracelsus.
Paracelsus. Yeah. He actually had like six names and then.
von Hohheim. Yes.
Yeah.
But he said the dose makes the poison. And that's true. I mean, I covered this in my podcast, Plants of the Gods, where something that could harm you in great amounts can heal you in smaller amounts and vice versa. I mean, if you take 100 aspirin, it'll kill you. So we're now looking at things like snake venom and scorpion venom, which may have therapeutic potential. And even if it doesn't, it's teaching us new things about the nervous system. So it's not like, well, if a drug doesn't come to market, it you know, so what? Because if you look at the value of the herbal industry, there's a lot of healing going on there, but based on stuff that's not in the pharmacy. But once again, you know, not all herbs can do all things. What we want, I think, that the medical office, the future, the pharmacy of the future needs to have the traditional prescription pharmaceuticals, but herbs and other potions. I mean, Chinese medicine, if it didn't work, how come there's so many Chinese people? Of course, there's something to that. Same thing with Ayurvedic medicine. I don't understand the science behind it, but there doesn't seem any shortage of people in India. So right. Clearly, all of these systems do something well. The worry in my research, Greg, with these shamanic healers is they're preliterate cultures for the most part. And so the knowledge is not written down. And as modernity presses in from all sides, whether it's missionary activity or climate change, what have you, that these forests and this knowledge is being lost.
Yeah, you mentioned that in the piece. And we'll talk about that in the second half of it, because I'm very concerned, as I think everybody is, about, you know, what that means and what the effects of climate change are there in particular, because, you know, the forest, the rainforest there is obviously so important to, you know, life on Earth and stuff. So I do want to cover that. But talk a little bit about the other, just so people who haven't read or aware, some of the discoveries or medicinal, like there's a way that what you were talking about where it's in the middle, it's the herb or the, you know, the frog lair skin or something like that, plus the chemical ability to, you know, break that down, figure out what it is, how to mass produce it, how to mix it with other things to make it, you know, usable and safe. One of the things in the article was statins, which, you know, atorvastatin, I take that, you know, for my cholesterol. And I was interested, I was surprised to learn this is something that's relatively new and came out of research in the Amazon, right?
Well, statins didn't come from the Amazon. Statins came from a fungus that was found elsewhere. But I've never met a physician who knew that statins were a natural product and they came from penicillium fungus. Okay. So that when you ask people what comes from penicillium, they say penicillin. Well, actually, that's not the first gift of penicillium fungus to our species, blue cheese. The blue and blue cheese is penicillium fungus. Statins are penicillium fungus. And as much as we know, or as little as we know about the plants of the Amazon, we know even less of the fungi of the Amazon or all tropical forests or all forests everywhere. But just this week, Greg, they found a new species of hallucinogenic mushroom in Ecuador and named it after the great Paul Stamets, who was a leading mycologist. If people have seen Fantastic Fungi, it's one of the best documentaries ever made, highly recommended. So if we can still go into the forest and find new hallucinogenic fungi, or if we go into the Amazon River and find two new species of electric eels have been studied since Linnaeus 250 years ago, and now studying the batteries to find out how to make pacemakers last longer in the human body. Imagine what's out there in terms of the little brown crawling things that nobody's ever looked at. So I started out at the World Wildlife Fund, and it was all about whales and elephants and things like that. And yeah, we should be protecting those things. But the little creepy crawlies and some of the poisonous creepy crawlies may end up having more therapeutic potential and benefit for all of us.
It's really interesting the way that and you write about this too in some of the other pieces about ethnobotany, the way that it's layered with myth and legend and stuff like that, and the properties of these plants and stuff. I don't know. There's a literary value to it, is what I'm trying to say. I think it's like you know, the idea that this thing is poisonous and the snake is poisonous, but it can save you. That's like a plot of some movie that we would, some Star Wars thing that we would watch, right? I think that's what Mandalorian's going, you know, this season.
There's plenty of movies that could be made from this, but you know, that TV series, The Rest of Us, that's all based on the cordyceps fungus. Okay. This is why I did a little piece, which I'll send you. Maybe we can put it in the end notes, called Why Ethnobotanists Don't Read Science Fiction. Okay. This is a fungus that attaches itself to insects when they go past. The fungus burns a hole in the insect exoskeleton. The fungus inserts itself inside the insect exoskeleton. The fungus eats all of the insect's non-vital organs. The fungus then goes up and eats the insect brain, causing the insect to split apart and release the spores above the forest. This is the inspiration for this TV series. It's a smash. So yeah, there's many, many, many stories like this in nature. Some of them are quite lovely. Some of them are quite horrifying. But, you know, when you think about what weird and wonderful chemicals could still be out there, you got to remember that Mother Nature has been inventing weird and wonderful chemicals for 3 billion years. So she's definitely got a head start on our best chemists.
Now, my wife was getting into that Last of Us show, and she usually doesn't like that kind of thing. But she was like, while we were watching the first episode, she said, "Well, I know this can't actually happen." She said, "I know that it can't happen because the fungi, they can't, you know, if it's above a certain degree." So is that accurate? Can this not happen? Because they sort of say the thing, there's a suspension of disbelief where the thing mutates. But
I think all of us, as we go through life, learn you should never say never, right? But at this point in time, there's no danger of that fungus invading us and, you know, eating our insides and popping out of our head. But who's to say that it wouldn't happen in the future? So it's better to say, as far as we know right now, it's not happening. It can't happen. But with all the changes going on in the world, it's better to be safe than sorry.
Now, you mentioned the documentary, Fantastic Fungi. So I think after I watched it, I wrote you because I felt like I wanted to see what your thoughts were about it, because I wasn't sure if you would be, which you just said, which is that it's great, or if you'd be like, this guy's on my corner, you know, what's going on. So, I learned about that, you know, they're all sort of connected underneath the ground, all of these mushrooms and fungi. And I got the deep sense that, you know, this whole planet belongs to the mushrooms and we're just here almost by accident or something. What were your thoughts watching that movie when you saw it the first time? Like,
when you're close to a subject, you watch it with different eyes. You know, if you're a historian, you pick up a popular history book, and the first you're going, "That's not right. That's not right. That's right." So, because you're a little bit of an intellectual snob, and I'm watching the thing going, "This is great. They're really telling it. It's all right. It's all accurate." So, I loved it. I've recommended it. I mean, if I had a commission for all the people I turned on to it, I'd be wealthier than I am today. So, I think it's terrific. And one of the backstories there that I thought they told well without sensationalizing it is this whole idea of the psychedelic renaissance, where these hallucinogens start, you know, psilocybin, but many others, are offering new treatment for incurable diseases like depression, schizophrenia, PTSD. A lot of money going into PTSD right now because they're having a lot of success treating some veterans, not all of it, with it. So it just once again shows that how little we know about stuff that we're still learning about. At the same time, we're destroying it faster than ever. So on the one hand, it's very heartening. On the other hand, it's very, very disturbing.
When did the idea of like microdosing come about? Is that a fairly recent thing, or people have been doing it for centuries?
No, I'd never heard about it until recently. I mean, it's a thing, as they say, meaning it's a recent phenomenon. But there's a fellow at LSU Medical School in my hometown, New Orleans, who has been looking at small doses of hallucinogenic principles for treating things like asthma, which is not something you think of associated with hallucinogens. The point being that these compounds are bioactive. They do something in the human bodies. They may be affecting something other than our mind. And once again, shows that the value of this stuff, it's much more shamanic in a sense. It's not like, okay, this is good for this mental ailment, but for nothing else.
Right.
And I think that's where this microdosing is going to come into this modern research. It's going to show that actually there are some effects in the body, but it's too early to quantify them. But it just means it's very exciting. So do I believe in microdosing? Science isn't something you need to believe in. It either is or isn't. It's a fact or it's not. So early indications are that this microdosing is having a positive effect in some cases. I think like anything to do with hallucinogens, it's often oversold. But Paul Stamets, who I mentioned earlier, who's in Fantastic Fungi, has developed a test that's showing some increased enhanced coordination using these microdoses. So I guess the short answer question is stay tuned, but there are some very positive indications that it does have some positive effects.
That's good. This is all, you know, this is all good news. Other than the second part of the podcast will be focusing on the bad news. But you know, for now, this is good news. Now, you've written, as I mentioned, these pieces about ethnohistory, I guess, the ethnobotanical approach to history. And I found them fascinating because it's something that I just haven't thought about at all. And it should. The relationship between, you know, plants and people is obviously super important throughout historical times. In one of the articles, you talk about, you know, why Rome fell, and it might be, you know, plant-based in some sense, and the deforestation where they cut down, you know, so many trees in Italy that they, you know, the society can't sustain itself in the way that it had before, which there's obviously things that we can learn and apply from that to our own society. But what interested me most of all in these pieces are these sort of, you know, things that we all know and some that we don't, and what the histories really were. So I just want to throw a few of these at you, so you can talk about them, because I think they're really cool and people are going to want to hear about them. So, okay, the first one, wine. So wine is good for us, I guess, is the takeaway.
I think that wine had more to do with the development of Western culture than any other plants other than the cereal grains, wheat, rye, things like that, and corn in the New World, because this is something that came out of the Caucasus. The breadbasket for wine is that area where Georgia and Iran and Turkey come together. It's very clearly that is where wine was first created. Now, wine makes itself, okay? If you let grapes ferment, they'll produce wine. With beer, you have to make it, which is another story. But when people started making wine, they found these fabulous ruins in that part of the world. Really, the expert in this is Pat McGovern at the University of Pennsylvania Museum. And that was then taken to what we call the Middle East, moving west, where those people glommed onto it and started moving around the Mediterranean, where the Greeks became obsessed with it. And they built their economy based on wine and trading for wine. And Greece is actually a pretty crappy country when it comes to soils. There's no major rivers in Greece. Think about it. And so they wanted to find a place with better soils and rivers. So what has the best soils in the Mediterranean? A place called Italy.
Yeah.
Because of Mount Vesuvius. And so that Italy was settled by a bunch of tribes who were there, but as Greek colonies as well, Magna Graecia as they called it. And that ended up with the trading with Carthage and moving into France and Spain and places like that. So this is much of the evolution of Western culture, which I never learned in history class, and I'm kind of a history nut, that these plants undergirded a part of this. This is not to say that, you know, the Western culture is due to wine, but I do think it's fair to say that Western culture, if you really want to understand the roots of it and how it got moved around, and that's intended to be a pun, it certainly had to do with the grapevine.
Now, you mentioned beer. That was the next thing on my list. I don't think it's in the article, but I remember reading long ago that the recipe or the how to make beer, the formula, whatever you want to call it, was written on some pyramid and that the Egyptians knew how to do it. Is that true? Or is that just, I just read that on some pre-internet thing?
Probably oversimplistic. There are accounts of beer making amongst the Sumerians and the Babylonians and people like that. But here's what's interesting, just to repeat myself, that wine makes itself, but beer has to be made. So there's a debate in our community. I mean, not that that's a lot of people. did these people invent bread to make beer? Or did they invent beer to make bread? Because the two are tied in together. And this is something which has not been settled. But in one of the articles I sent you on the ethnobotany of wine in the ancient Mediterranean, maybe we'll put a link in the show notes, this whole history of who drank beer and who drank wine. Okay, the people who drank beer were in much more arid places like Egypt. The people who drank wine were in much more lush places like Italy. And there was, and if you don't think that that affects the world today, look at who drinks beer today, the Germans.
Yeah.
Okay. Look at who drinks wine today, the Italians. That goes back 2,000 years to the history of empire and what people evolved their culture around drinking.
There's a great scene in I, Claudius, the great, you know, Robert Graves novel about, you know, Claudius and the thing, where the Germanic tribes win a battle and they take the wine barrels from the Romans that they, you know, they just win all the stuff at the camp. And then they proceed to drink the wine like it's beer, because that's what they're used to drinking.
and they get like so fucked up that they can't function because they drink too much of it too quickly. And it's a pretty funny scene, something you don't think about, you know, but yeah, they're doing the, you know.
There's an ethnobotany angle to I, Claudius that few people are aware of. My mentor Schultes went to Oaxaca in southern Mexico in the late 30s in search of magic mushrooms. And nobody knew there were magic mushrooms in Mexico or anywhere else. And he found them. And then his next stop was the Amazon, where he went for a year and stayed for 14. Meanwhile, a banker in New York who worked for J.P. Morgan was married to a Russian physician who loved mushrooms. In Russia, they grew up, you know, collecting and eating mushrooms. But when they were on their honeymoon in the Catskills, she said, oh, look, mushrooms, let's eat them. And he said, oh, my God, toadstools, no, we'll die. Well, she cooked them, she ate them, she didn't die, and they decided to work on the history of mushrooms and its impact in culture. These are the Wassons. So they became interested in how mushrooms affected human culture, and they decided they would try and settle the ultimate cold case, the death of Claudius.
Okay.
Which, according to Robert Graves and Diaz Caso and Suetonius, his wife gave him mushrooms, and that's what killed him. But nobody had ever figured out what they were. So they wanted to investigate this. Who knew more about Claudius than anybody else? This is in the 50s, Robert Graves. Yeah. So Valentina Wasson wrote to Graves, and together they figured out that it was the death cap mushroom.
Wow. So okay. Yeah. Robert Graves, by the way, for anyone listening who doesn't know, is clearly one of the most brilliant people that ever walked the earth. I mean, he has that book, White Goddess, that's just his notes on crazy ancient shit. And it's just, you know, you got to really be a brainiac to follow that. I can't follow along that well. And I know a lot about Rome and all that stuff, but he's like next level with his research and stuff. So that's...
I encourage people to start with I, Claudius, Greg.
Yeah, I, Claudius is
a wonderful book.
It's a fantastic book.
And then read Claudius the God, the sequel, and then go back and watch the BBC series, which is absolutely terrific, and then go back and read the books again.
The BBC series is sort of like... It's very similar to Star Trek in some ways because they're like hour episodes. And at the beginning of the episode, some new good-looking person shows up and then they're dead by the end of the episode. Like it has the same beats as Star Trek. It's pretty interesting, I thought.
And the connection to Star Trek is you have Patrick Stewart with hair playing Sejanus.
Sejanus, yeah.
But here's the difference. I, Claudius, which is a gripping series, is a bunch of British guys wearing bath towels. Right. There's no computer generated imagery. There's no scenes in the Colosseum, but the story is so gripping you don't care.
Yeah, it's very, very good. And most of it is about Caligula. You know, there's Tiberius. Caligula is a vast part in the middle of the story, which is, you know, he's a fascinating character. Okay. The next one on my list of substances here is opium. That's been around forever. But how long has it been around?
Well, I think the earliest finds are maybe 5,000 years ago in the Middle East. And clearly, it was easily and early recognized as a very powerful painkiller. And then people started using it for a bunch of things, including recreation, which is, of course, is dangerous because it is so highly addictive. But it's, again, one of those plants that's deeply intertwined with our society. If you think that's ancient history and, you know, a Chinese opium den, that's ancient history. Look at all the problems of drugs around the world. Because a lot of those like heroin or methadone are tied directly to opium. So the story continues.
Yeah. The opium thing with China and Britain is really I think people don't realize what happened there, which is that the British wanted tea. The Chinese were like, you don't have anything that we want. Fuck off. And then the British snuck opium in there that they were growing in India and got enough people addicted to it that they had to then trade it for that was kind of the root of it, which is really, you know, kind of evil and nefarious, you know, all because of the tea. Fascinating stuff. Next and last on my list of substances is myrrh, which we know about from the Bible. And as you point out from The Life of Brian, quite the best Monty Python movie. And really, Life of Brian applies to so much stuff happening now that it kind of blows my mind to watch it. It really does. Like, anyway, so tell us about myrrh.
I will, but I want to talk about The Life of Brian first.
Let's do that. Please.
After I graduated from college, I was reading an issue of Harvard Magazine where they had this wonderful old classics professor who was much beloved. He was sort of a Goodbye Mr. Chips character. In his last class, he was teaching the grandchildren of of kids in his first class, you know, 40, 50 years before. And so they were interviewing this wonderful classic scholar, sort of an exit interview about lessons learned and what we can tell from the ancient world about the world we live in. And they said, so what is the greatest cinematic depiction of the Middle East when Jesus walked there? You know, was it Quo Vadis? Was it Ben-Hur? He said, oh, no, without a doubt, it was the Life of Brian.
I believe it. It really is. Anybody who hasn't seen it, go see it immediately. But there's the one scene that I love where it's they're trying to do an insurrection against the Romans, and it's the Judean People's Front meeting, and they're like, "What have the Romans ever done for us?" They're like, "Well, they built the roads." Was, well, yeah, you know the roads, and then they just list 20 things that the Romans did.
It's the most brilliant defense of colonialism ever put on film.
Yeah, that is one way of looking at it. It's very, very good. And
to tie Mur into the Life of Brian, there's this hilarious scene where they go into the wrong manger and they give Brian's mother the gift of the Magi, which is, of course, gold and frankincense and myrrh. And she says, next time, just bring more gold.
But not so much myrrh next time.
The gift was gold and myrrh and frankincense. Myrrh and frankincense were the antibiotics of the ancient world. Everybody was kind of pretty stinky back then. But it wasn't just incense to make things smell better. It killed bacteria. And it's been tested in the lab. And this is long before penicillin was discovered. So this was the gift of life. It wasn't just gold and two sort of things that nobody wanted.
It's also, it had midwifery applications too, right? The myrrh, was myrrh the one that's like topical that they use to treat wounds, or was that something else?
It's topical. You can ingest it and it smells good, and it's, you know, very much tied into religious practice. You know, when the first Catholics got to the Amazon, there was no frankincense, but they found a plant of the same family which smells a lot like it, and the indigenous people use it as incense there.
Okay, so speaking of the eye, I have one more Amazon question. You mentioned in the piece there's something called Piri Piri. Am I saying it right?
Right. Okay. Yes.
That seems to be kind of their cure-all for everything. What is that exactly, and what does it do? And is it something that...
It's a great story. And for decades, ethnobotanists were told this plant is Piri Piri. It's good as a female contraceptives and has all sorts of other uses. In fact, it's called the ginseng of the Amazon. Except that the plant was a sedge, which is kind of related to grasses, doesn't have much chemistry going on there. So everybody thought that the indigenous peoples were kind of pulling our leg. But a colleague of mine learned the language, spent over a decade there. His name's Glenn Shepherd. And it turns out that Piri Piri does work for a lot of things because it's a sedge, but it's a sedge that's invaded by a fungus. And that fungus is related to ergot, which was the hallucinogen that led to the Salem witch trials, and which Albert Hofmann was studying. And when he diddled the chemical a little, came up with a 25th variation, which we know as LSD-25. So this is once again how fungi have had an important impact in our culture. And the way that Glenn essentially cracked the case was he took the stuff and then stood up and was able to, you know, juggle four balls at once and juggle behind his back when he was a pretty terrible juggler. He said, there's something going on with this stuff, you know, because the indigenous people said, oh, in addition to all the medicinal application, it makes you a better hunter. And so, yeah, you can see better, you can shoot better, you're stronger because of this stuff. But it took years of figuring out what the indigenous peoples were telling us before we really got the story straight. So this goes back to your earlier question about myth and symbolism and stuff like that. Just a lot of the time, we're not really sure what they're trying to tell us.
Yeah, it's interesting. Okay, wait, you mentioned the Salem witch trial and the hallucinogens. I don't think I know that story. What's that story?
Okay, we all know the Salem witch trials, where these women were diagnosed as witches who claim to see visions and go to bad places and do bad things. And the theory is that the crop they were growing, which I think was wheat or rye, they had a wet winter, and it was invaded by a fungus, which is a fungus called ergot. And so they really were hallucinating, and they really were seeing devils and things like that. And some were put to death. So, you know, there are explanations for some of these things that seem sort of fantastic and might be just a bunch of malarkey, as our president would say, but there may be a biological or a fungal basis to this.
Interesting.
And just to back up here for a second, another colleague of mine, Brian Mora Rescue, wrote a book called The Immortality Key, in which he posits that the origin of Christianity is not so much tied to Judaism as it is to ancient Greek practice called the Eleusinian Mysteries, when they were drinking something that caused them to hallucinate, and that was based on ergot. So that the Christian mass, when you're drinking that stuff, and this is the blood and this is the flesh, you may not understand what's going on there. He thinks it may have been that they were drinking ergot, and to them it was blood and flesh.
I know this story because my friend Whitney Fishburne has a podcast where she talks about kind of the intersection of theology and stuff like that. And she had a long interview with him, which is really fascinating. I listened to it on the train ride home one day, and I was like, my mind was sort of blown by that whole thing. So it's interesting. It's guy. Stuff.
And recently they found an altar near Jerusalem, which was full of marijuana. Okay. Cannabis was moved around a lot in the ancient world, as was opium. And so you may have had cannabis as part of Judaism in this particular part of what is now Israel. The point being that these religions are not, you know, linear, that everybody did everything the same way all the time in all the places, and that all the so-called major religions, I never liked that term, have incorporated stuff from other religions or pre-existing religions and beliefs. So the idea that Islam didn't have anything to do with mind-altering stuff, I mean, I guess it's possible, but you look at Zoroastrianism, and there's a colleague in British Columbia who's now found some of the same alkaloids in a plant they were ingesting, the Zoroastrians were ingesting, that are similar to that found in ayahuasca in the Amazon. So all of these things kind of connect in unanticipated ways, I think.
Interesting. What's your take on cannabis, by the way, as a, because there's that, you know, it used to be, I mean, even when I was in high school, it was really kind of taboo almost. And you know, people did it, but it wasn't like it is now where it's, you know, socially accepted to the point where there's, you know, you can go and legally buy it in some states and stuff like that. And there's, I think the people that love it, you know, want to say, no, it's harmless and it doesn't do anything and it's good for this, and this, which is obviously true to some degree. But what's your take on it?
Well, it's not as cool as it used to be for the reasons you said. I think we grew up in the same era. It was kind of, you're kind of a buccaneer doing something that was forbidden. Now, when I go home and walk to the French Quarter, I get sick of the smell of marijuana because it's so ubiquitous. So like many of these plants, many of these drugs, many of these hallucinogens, which cannabis isn't, it's kind of been oversold as the cure for everything. I do think it has a place in the Western medical armamentarium. I mean, I take CBD sometimes because it helps with sleep and things like that. And clearly, you know, it can relax people. Clearly, Western medicine doesn't have a great cure, even a great treatment for stress. So, yeah, it's got a role to play. There are some downsides to it. I did an interview with Hamilton Morris where he talked about this new syndrome where people that smoke it too much, and it's rare, but it exists. There's a problem that exists which can make people quite sick. So I don't want to make it sound like reefer madness, like if you smoke a joint, you're going to die, because that's what we were told growing up, right? I mean, yeah, it was a gateway drug. If you smoke marijuana, you'd go on to harder drugs. Well, by that definition, Gerber baby food was a gateway drug, because if you Gerber baby food growing up, we didn't, and you ended up smoking cannabis. Not sure there's cause and effect there. Get my point.
Okay, I've got a bunch more questions. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Mark Plotkin. Okay, we're back with Mark Plotkin. So, all right, we got to talk about all the bad stuff now, all the climate change stuff, because I'm interested in your, and I know you, when I asked you about this, you said, I'm not a climatologist, and that's fine. We understand that. However, you've been going to the Amazon for many years now. You've seen firsthand if there's changes. So my first question is, you personally, what have you observed, you know, the first couple of times you've gone there versus now? What kind of changes have you seen?
Well, a lot of my work, like I said, is in the Northeast Amazon, in the country of Suriname on the Brazilian border. And when I started there in the late 70s, they had two rainy seasons and two dry seasons. You could almost set your clock by it. And now you can't. because it changed over time. And this isn't something recent. This is in the last 10 years. So that, you know, that might sound like, oh, so what? Except when you make a living off the land and you have to eat what you farm, this can really wreak havoc with a lot of these people. But 15 years ago, I was in the Colombian Amazon with a medicine man. We're walking through his garden. I mean, here's me in my REI togs, and here he is in a breechcloth. And we're walking through the garden, and I see this section, all the cassava, which is their main crop, is dying. And I said, oh, is it a disease or what's going on there? He says, cambio de clima, climate change. Mm. So that this is real. When I worked in Oaxaca with the mushroom cults 20 years ago, one of the paramount shamans said to me, she said, you know, when I was a kid, there were two mushrooms that we like to use for treating particular conditions, and they're gone. The climate's changing, and it's dried up, and they don't exist anymore. So climate change isn't something where, you know, somebody's flipped on or flipped off the light. It's been happening for a while. But it's when people live closer to the land that it affects them. And, you know, in an age where we're concerned about refugees and the borders and stuff like this, if people who live off the land can't live off the land, they end up somewhere else. And whether that's climate change in Syria, whether it's climate change in Haiti, you're just creating more problems, first and foremost, for the people themselves. But ultimately, it impacts all of us.
So in Brazil, does Brazil have the largest percentage of land that's in the rainforest, or is it somewhere
else? Yes, 66% of the Amazon is in Brazil.
Okay, that's what I thought. So, you know, that Bolsonaro there, I mean, he's not there now, but it was there for a while, this right. kind of Trumpian strongman type. How bad is that to have somebody like that there? How much damage did he do?
Well, we like to think that our country, you know, the world's oldest democracy, the wealthiest country, yada, yada, yada. I mean, one person could really change all that much in 4 years, and now we know that they can.
Yeah.
So when you had a president who was ardently anti-environment, nominally pro-business, we had the fastest and greatest extent of deforestation in recorded history. You now have President Lula, who's trying to reverse a lot of those priorities and doing a pretty good job. We have President Petro in Colombia, who hasn't gotten near the coverage that Lula has. But he's been even more outspoken about the importance of conservation. And, you know, I had an argument with the Brazilian minister a couple of years ago where he said, we need jobs. And I said, well, everybody needs jobs. But I just came back from the soy farms in the state of Mato Grosso, and it's all mechanized. Now, I'm not blaming you for that. I mean, mechanized agriculture, the origins of it have a lot more to do with my country than yours. But when you can manage these agricultural monocultures for miles and miles and miles with a handful of people and some big machines, you're not creating jobs. You're making the land untenable for all the Indians or peasants or caboclos or campesinos who once lived there. So this whole argument about if you're for conservation, you're against jobs is absolute nonsense. And that point can't be said too many times here or there.
Why do you think people like that deny the climate change? Because there's definitely, as I see it anyway, this sort of alliance of the fossil fuel people and these, you know, autocratic governments like Putin, like the, you know, Bolsonaro when he was in Brazil. You know, you've got Orban, you've got in South Africa. Why do they want this? Do they just not care? Like, what do you think the rationale is? Let the record show he is making the money symbol with his.
Typically, in strongman culture, as I observe it, and I'm not a political scientist, strongmen are supported by oligarchs.
Yeah.
And that's true everywhere. That's not just Putin. Okay. And oligarchs are all about the money. So there's money to be made at the top of the food chain. If you're not having to grow what you eat, and what do people want when they make $1 billion? Well, most of them, certainly not all of them, is more money. Because that becomes a self-perpetuating phenomenon. Also, you get into this sort of mindset, and I listened to Ruth Ben-Gion on your show, this sort of mindset where they all start thinking alike, where, you know, if one strong man's doing it, I've got to do it. And that anybody who's agitating for poor people or landless peasants, whatever, is against me. And you can make a lot of noise about how you're looking out for the little guy, but we all know that that's not really what they do. And also, you get into these belief systems. It's like people saying, well, do you believe in climate change? I'm like, I don't have to believe in climate change. It's real. It's a fact. It's like saying, well, do you believe, how can you believe in evolution? It's just a theory. And I said, yeah, like the theory of gravity, right?
Yeah, go fly.
It doesn't matter if you believe in it. It's real. It's here. And we got to deal with it.
Yeah. Yeah. So now you are part of the Amazon conservation team, right? You're the what's your title? The co-founder? Is that what it is?
Yeah, I'm the president.
That's what I
work for large organizations like the World Wildlife Fund, Conservation International, and they were focused on saving species. And then you had other organizations that focused on helping indigenous peoples. But 30 years ago, the best rainforests were in indigenous areas, and nobody was helping them for conservation purposes. So I saw an opportunity to partner with these people to help them protect their culture and their forest and protect a lot of forest in the process. So we have had the opportunity to partner with over 100 tribes in South America, mostly Amazonia, but some outside the Amazon, to help them map and improve management over 90 million acres of ancestral rainforest. That's our niche.
That's great. That's great. So is this a nonprofit?
It's a nonprofit. We're on the web at AmazonTeam.org, and we don't have a big fundraising department. We don't call people at home and ask them for money. We're not stuffing your mailbox with letters asking you for more money. But, you know, this is how we gather support. Programs like this, through my podcast, giving talks, writing books, letting people know that we're not going to take their money and use it to raise more money. We're going to take it and use it to save or try and save the rainforest.
Which, you know, needs to be saved, because if we don't save it, we're all going to die. Not to be alarmist, but, you know.
Well, I in my last book, The Amazon, What Everybody Needs to Know, that I did for Oxford Press, I said, let me be clear. Thank you. Let me be clear. The battle over climate change cannot be won in the Amazon, but it can be lost.
There you go. That, I like that. Yeah.
Yes. We have an obligation to look out for ourselves doing this. I mean, we're already seeing Brazil's breadbasket is not the Amazon. It's eastern Brazil, and they've had terrible droughts, and now they're having terrible downpours, because part of the manifestation of climate change is the rainy season gets more rainy and the dry season gets more dry, and then they switch places, which wreaks havoc. And it's even been found to impact stuff in our own breadbasket here in the States, where changing deforestation in the Amazon is believed to be impacting rains in the American Midwest, which, let's face it, feeds the world, and which, let's face it, in an age where Ukraine is being absolutely crushed, that Ukraine was the breadbasket of a lot of the world at the same time.
Right. So here's a question that I have that I'm almost afraid to ask. And again, I know you're not a climatologist, so I'll take it with a grain of salt. We'll have that caveat. But where is this going? You know, if things continue the way that they are, you hear a lot of people like say about the clock is almost at midnight, and you have people that know a lot about this stuff that are, you know, crazy gluing their hands to the floors of places to get attention, and people who are in that field are shouting from the rooftops and have been for quite some time. Is it going to be a thing where there's just droughts and hurricanes and like you said, like places that grew a lot of food suddenly stop growing a lot of food, and there's going to be famines? Is it going to be releases some plague? Like what do you think is going to happen? What are the projections like?
Look, people ask me all the time, with the Amazon, is the glass half full or is it half empty? And the bottom line is, any glass that's half full is half empty. Right? And vice versa. So here's the bad news. Okay, the impact of climate change is already there. You've got rising temperatures, you've got diminished rainfall, you've got more rainfall in some areas, you've got increasing droughts in some areas, you've got variations in seasonality, like I told you about the wet and the dry seasons mm-hmm. moving around. And the species of the rainforest, both the animals and the plants and even the fungi, as a species are not adapted to rapid changes in temperature, like, you know, animals here, they used to a winter, they used to a summer, not there. Also, many of the animals, like birds and monkeys, if you cut a road through a rainforest, they will not come down and cross that road. Birds will not fly. Some birds will not fly from one patch of forest to another. So these changes have already happened in a significant amount of the Amazon, between a quarter and a third. But here's the good news. You have President Lula in Brazil saying, no more deforestation. You've got President Petro in Colombia, who really needs to get more attention for saying the same thing. You have Biden. You know, people think he's this old guy over the hill. He's made several impassioned speeches about the rainforest. He met with President Lula. It was a love fest. So the good news is that people are paying attention. There's more money going into this than before. There's more tension going into this before. And let's face it, we're all coming out of this dreadful pandemic. Ecotourism is going to go through the roof, right? And people want to see nature because they've been living in their damn house for 3 years. So yeah. The value of standing rainforests, the value of coral reefs, that can only go up. And so the idea that the only good rainforest is a dead rainforest, or that we need to cut it all down to make cheap soy for the Chinese or chopsticks or something. I'm sorry, but the wonder drugs tomorrow being turned into cheap soy and chopsticks and the rivers being poisoned so people can have gold necklaces strikes me as a pretty lame bargain.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree. Okay, so we're coming up on time. We had talked before this about your background, your personal background with regards to Russia and your ancestors basically fleeing the Tsar at every turn. So, and you said you had a good Nicholas II story. So I want to hear about all this.
I had a great uncle born and raised in Vilnius, Vilna, Lithuania. That used to be a center of Jewish culture before the Nazis essentially killed all of them. And he left in the early 1900s to come to the U.S. because they were being conscripted for the army of the Tsar. Okay, the story doesn't change. This is why Jews are following these headlines so closely. But he told me one time he went to a parade in Vilna and his mother held him up in the air so he could see over the crowd. And there went a man in the most fantastic carriage he'd ever seen. And he said, "Gee, Mama, who's that?" And she said, "That's Tsar Nicholas."
Wow. Okay.
Likewise, the other side of the family, they came from Belarus and then went to Kyiv and settled there. And then when the pogroms swept in and the Tsar wanted to conscript all the Jews for the army. And we all know that people in the Russian army are not treated well, soldiers not treated well. Well, the Jews were treated much, much worse. Back then, you had Tsar Alexander II, the reformer, who tried to lift the burden from the Jews, and then he was assassinated. And then Things got really worse in around 1880. So we're talking 20 years later where things were bad and getting worse still, and they all left for the New World, and here we are.
Well, I'm glad that you made it. But Nicholas II, one of the worst military, you know, overseer general types of all time. I mean, really just...
He may have some competition these days there, Greg.
It would be like Don Jr. being in charge of like the military for a war. Like, I can do this. I can. Yeah. And everyone's like, oh, no.
How difficult can it be?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a terrible idea. It's just a really bad idea. So, OK, Amazon conservation team, if you're listening to this and you want to support Mark and his work, check that out. I'll put a link to that, obviously, in the show notes. Where else can people find you?
Well, I'm on Twitter at Doc Mark Plotkin. I have a web page, a personal web page, a lot of my writings, markplotkin.com. And most important of all is amazonteam.org. You can support us on the web. Like I said, we'll take your money and spend it on conservation, not on fundraising. It's something we're very proud of.
That's good. It's been a pleasure talking to you today. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Well, Greg, the opportunity to have a chat with you after listening to so many of your wonderful podcasts is something I've been looking forward to for a long time.
So I hope I didn't let you down. I wanted it was a lot of fun. A lot of fun. We need to geek out on more historical stuff. I don't know. I'll have you on again and we'll just do a geek out on historical weird obscure stories episode. That'll be fun.
You want a closing story?
I want a closing story. Give me a closing story.
Ethnobotanists see things through the lens of ethnobotany. When I was a kid growing up and I'd look at, you know, John Ford cowboy movies or, you know, Daniel Boone, Davy Crockett, that stuff, I remembered how the Indians, to seal the deal and signify their friendship, would smoke the peace pipe. They take a hit, they pass it to the guy next to them, and so on and so forth. Well, let me tell you why that's the case. Because those Indians were smoking Nicotiana rustica, which is 9 times more potent, 9 times more nicotine than cigarettes. So when you took a hit of that stuff, you had to pass it around the circle for your head to clear. And nobody but an ethnobotanist can explain that to you.
That makes sense. I mean, a good cigar has that effect too. You're like, you know, you smoke it for a little while and then all of a sudden you're like, oh my God, wow. Yeah. it's fun. No, that's good. Okay. That's a good story to close on. Once again, Amazon conservation team, Mark Plotkin, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Greg.
The Prevail theme song is by Matthew Fawcett. Zarina Zabriskie, Marie Kost, and Martha Acuna provided the introduction in Ukrainian, French, and Spanish, respectively. Voice talent is by Stephanie St. John, Tally Briggs, Michelle Cantor, and me. Thanks to Allison Gill, Molly Hawkey, Kenai Williams, and everyone else at MSW Media. Please subscribe to the Prevail Substack with updates every Tuesday, Friday, and Sunday. Your $5 monthly subscription funds the column and the podcast. Visit gregoliar.com to learn more. Thanks for listening. Drive safely. Don't forget to tip your server. And until next time, we shall prevail.
Hey, scientists, how critical is pure water to you? In this new podcast, Lab Water Stories Unfiltered, we at Millipore Sigma look closer at this often overlooked lab essential. Tune in as experts drop tips and insights not found in textbooks, taken from their work with MilliQ Lab Water Solutions. Lab Water Stories Unfiltered. Find it wherever you get your podcasts. Millipore Sigma is the U.S. and Canada life science business of Merck KGaA Darmstadt, Germany.